From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump sits down for an exclusive interview with The Times. How a conversation about infrastructure veered off into allegations of spying, new thinking on the chemical attacks in Syria, and a response to the sexual harassment claims against Bill O'Reilly. And as Trump heads to Mar-a-Lago to meet with China's president, why his number one complaint about China makes for better politics than economics. It's Thursday, April 6th. At 11 a.m. on Wednesday morning, my colleagues Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush went to the White House to interview the president.
Seems like you will, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I do believe it's going to be outstanding, I hope.
Well, it was in the Oval Office. It's a beautiful sunny day. And what was really interesting about this was I've never had an interview. I've done a few Oval Office interviews before. I have never had an interview with so many people in the Oval Office. We sat in two out of the four chairs in front of the president's, the Resolute Desk in the Oval Office. To my left sat National Economic Council Chairman Gary Cohn, a very powerful player in the White House. To Maggie's right, Hope Hicks, a longtime assistant to the president. But as we were talking, essentially the entire cast of characters, it was like Hamilton, the entire cast of characters came in at one time or another. Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump. At some point in time, Mr. Trump interrupts the interview to say,
"Come on in, Mike. Come on in.
Hi, Mike."
You know Mike and Grimes.
Talking about the vice president and his chief of staff.
Just walking through?
Just walking right in, and they kind of hung around with arms crossed. And there was, a half a dozen other people. And we went in, Maggie and I, for what was billed as a wide-ranging discussion of his infrastructure plans, and boom!
I think the Susan Rice thing is a massive story.
We couldn't get a word out before he started hitting on Susan Rice.
I think it's a massive, massive story all over the world. I mean, other than the New York Times.
We've written about it twice.
Huh?
We've written about it twice.
Yeah, it's a bigger story than you know. I think,
you mean there's more information that we're not aware of?
I think it's going to be the biggest story.
Hmm.
Why? I mean, what do you think?
What else?
Well, take a look at what's happening. I mean, first of all, her performance was horrible yesterday on television, even though she was interviewed by Hillary Clinton's PR person, Andrea Mitchell. Of course, you've been accused of that also, so, you know.
Mostly by you, though.
No. Mostly by a lot of people.
We didn't ask him about Susan Rice. We were gonna. You know, the way that you play these interviews is that you have your list of perfunctory questions, right, on the topic. Not
sure.
That the infrastructure topic isn't important, but, you know, then you have kind of your secret questions in your pocket that you pop out during the lightning round at the end.
Well, just to summarize that, this is the reporting, which is still unfurling, that Susan Rice, as National Security Advisor to President Obama, was using that perch to essentially, according to these accusations, spy on the Trump campaign and the president. And we don't really have any evidence of that.
Oh, I mean, that's a huge part of this. And, you know, and we put it in our headline in the story instantaneously, which is a totally unsubstantiated charge.
It looks like it's breaking into a massive story.
What do you think of, what other shoes are there to drop?
Yeah, what else could we learn?
Oh, I think you're going to see a lot. I think you'll see a lot.
In terms of what she did and in terms of the type
I think of what other people have done also.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's one of the biggest stories.
He said it's the biggest story in the world. It's going to be huge. There are more players who are implicated. Of course, we followed up instantly and asked him, give us some evidence. What are the names of these people?
What are the people you think are going to get ensnared in this? Can you give us a sense? How far
from the
might
from
extend?
The previous administration?
I think from the previous administration.
How far do you think it goes?
Yeah.
Chief of staff?
I don't want to say, but...
President?
I don't want to say, but you know who... You know what was going on. You probably know better than anybody. I mean, I frankly think the Times is missing a big thing by not writing it because, you know, you're missing out on the biggest story there is.
And then he moved on to something else. And it struck me that the allegations were serious enough that I should follow up on that. And I said to him,
do you think she might have committed a crime?
Do I think?
Yeah.
Yes, I think.
Hmm.
Again, a totally unsubstantiated charge. We pressed him on it. To my surprise, he said, do I think that? Yeah, I think that.
Did you see the images out of Syria?
Horrible.
What do you think watching that?
I think it's a disgrace. I think it's an affront to humanity.
So you and Maggie had an exchange with the president about Syria.
Inconceivable that somebody could do that. Those kids were so beautiful to look at that, the scenes of those beautiful children being carried out.
I think he, like everybody else who has seen these horrific images, was just absolutely aghast.
All information points to Syria, mm-hmm. that they did this. Why they did this, who knows? That's a level, you know, first of all, they weren't supposed to have this. You know, Obama said, it's all cleared away. Well, that was another thing that he didn't do.
His impulse was to blame President Obama for drawing the red line.
Big moment in the Middle East was when Obama drew the red line in the sand and was immediately violated and did nothing. That was a big moment in the Middle East. I know you're not going to report that, but that was a big, bad moment for the Middle East.
We reported it extensively. And grilled Jay Carney and the president.
Yeah. I mean, think, if that were violated, you would not have had this happen.
And he started to talk about that, and, you know, we let him make his argument. But then we pressed him and said, well, what about Vladimir Putin?
Does this rise to the level of something he would contact Mr. Putin about?
Does this rise to the level of calling Vladimir Putin?
As an ally of Bashar al-Assad.
As an ally of Bashar al-Assad.
I never talk about what I do militarily.
Okay.
I've been complaining about that for years.
And he totally, I've listened to the tape a couple of times, I still can't figure out whether he said yes or no on that. But then we pressed him some more.
But what about Russia's role in all of this, in abetting the administration?
Well, I think it's very disappointing. I think it's very disappointing. Now, this was done by, I guess the information is this was done by Syria purely. But anybody aligned with Syria, this is very disappointing.
So the most we got out of him on that one was that he was disappointed with Vladimir Putin.
Glenn, what did he say about health care?
Do you feel there was movement on health care yesterday? There's been conflicting reports.
I do.
Okay.
Do you feel you surrendered any leverage in these health care?
Yeah.
Do you think these guys can...
No, I didn't surrender leverage. I'm not looking to gain leverage. I'm looking to get great health care.
And
the easiest thing for me to do would be not do health care. Just relax. Don't do it. If I don't do that, other things happen.
He seemed to indicate, and we've heard a lot of mixed messages out of his administration about this, he seemed to indicate that healthcare is very much alive.
But I'd rather solve it in a much better way for the country.
On infrastructure.
And I think we have a good chance.
These are the healthcare and infrastructure. One of the things that we'd heard over the past couple of months was that you early on were very enthusiastic about infrastructure as a way to sort of bring all these forces together.
I am.
Together.
Yep.
And that you might have preferred to have done infrastructure first.
Yes.
Who sold you on doing it the other way? And do you regret not doing infrastructure first?
What accounted for the change?
Because,
tell us your process.
Because infrastructure is so popular that I might want to use it for another bill.
He might attach infrastructure to it just because infrastructure is so popular.
To a healthcare bill.
To a healthcare bill.
To make it more palatable.
Correct. Or to a tax reform bill.
So in other words, so it's a sweetener for something else.
Very simple. Because infrastructure is so popular with the Democrats and pretty popular with the Republicans. A lot of Republicans want infrastructure, too.
He essentially views the infrastructure bill as the sugar that makes the medicine go down.
Hmm.
So he's trying to figure out, according to what he said to us today, the best vehicle to attach infrastructure bill to because it is so popular.
It's number one, we need it as a country. Most importantly, we need it. We have to fix our roads and our bridges, and we need it. And our airports, by the way, which are third world airports. You look at these airports, they're horrible. I mean, you go to Kennedy, you go to LAX, these airports are horrible. I'm a person that before I was doing this, I was in Qatar, and I was all over the world, and I was in different places in China. And you see airports, it's like we are third world.
Right, Joe Biden said.
That's right.
The point is that infrastructure is, in my opinion, very popular. It's going to be bipartisan, and I'm going to use it in another bill.
A lot of political analysts and people who really know the Hill say it will have difficulty getting passed, particularly in its incarnation as has been leaked out, which is mostly tax credits. Dems aren't going to go for that.
That's an important
bill. What would be a signature piece of infrastructure beyond roads and bridges? What would be a standout project?
Well, we're looking at that, and we're going to announce something very, very soon.
Maggie asked the president about Bill O'Reilly, who the president describes as a friend. And
the financial settlements that Bill O'Reilly has paid out to women who appeared on or worked on Fox.
Do you think that this is that he's being unfairly treated?
I think he's a person I know well. He's a good person. I think he may, you know, I think he shouldn't have settled.
Mm.
Personally, I think he shouldn't have settled.
How come?
Because you should have taken it all the way. No, I know Bill. Bill's a good person.
Were you struck by his response?
Yeah, I was. I mean, the thing that really struck me is, again, just like with the Susan Rice stuff, it wasn't like we were pulling this stuff out of him. He seemed really eager to talk about it.
I don't think Bill would do anything wrong.
Can we get to infrastructure? Because I'm sensitive about time.
I understand.
Glenn, how did this 20-something minute interview end?
It ended, as most of them do, with an aide, in this case, Hope Hicks, informing the president that it was time to do something else.
How polite.
It was very polite. I have to say, he was in a very good mood, it seemed, to both Maggie and I. We can confirm that he was in a really good mood. And, you know, the other thing about it is this White House, unlike the Obama White House, which is really sort of a contained, very staff-driven place, you walk around the Trump West Wing, and all the players are just, as I said before, hanging around, you know. As we're walking out, we nearly ran into Melania Trump, who was walking into the Oval Office. So there is a real sense of life. There's a sense of activity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you almost feel as if you're, you know, that you're walking into the middle of somebody's life.
And I guess you are.
Yeah.
Glenn, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Thanks to you and Maggie for this really insightful interview, and appreciate your time.
Great.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
We'll be right back. As a candidate for president, Donald Trump relentlessly hammered two foreign trade partners, Mexico and
China.
He mentioned the country so often,
China,
that the mentions became a meme.
China, big league, China.
China, 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 China.
China, 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 China,
China, China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China, China,
China, China.
And at the center of Trump's complaints about China,
we have a $500 billion deficit, trade deficit with China. We're going to turn it around.
Is what he calls a disastrous trade deficit.
Because we can't continue to allow China to rape our country. And that's what they're doing.
Peter, I'm going to do a quiz with you while you're sitting here. Ready?
Yeah, sure.
Exactly how big is the United States trade deficit with China?
You'll have to check. I believe it was $374 billion last year.
And relative to our trade deficits with other countries, is that big?
Yeah, it's big.
Peter Goodman is a global economics reporter. He inverted the 7 and the 4. It's $347 billion. Still big. I spoke with Peter as President Trump meets with Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago today. Peter, a deficit sounds inherently bad. Is it?
No. In terms of trade, most economists think that bilateral deficits, meaning deficits from one country to another,
like maybe China and the U.S.,
are effectively meaningless. I mean, in our own lives, we can understand why. I personally have a longstanding trade deficit with my dentist. I seem to spend a lot of money on my dentist. He has yet to purchase a thing for me. But we assume that he takes the money that I'm spending on tedious root canal procedures and goes out to eat and buys stuff for his kids and maybe hires a contractor and gets his stuff dry cleaned.
Right.
In one way or another, some of those people take their money and they buy subscriptions to the New York Times and my salary gets paid.
I love the analogy. What about the specific relationship between the U.S. and China?
Well, there are reasons to be concerned about bilateral trade deficits if you know the particulars of the story. Now, in terms of China and the United States, there are reasons to believe that China is taking some liberties in terms of complying with the norms of international trade. And that's a problem. And so there are reasons to look at the bilateral trade deficit and say that maybe it's bigger than it ought to be. But if China were a paragon of of commitment to trading rules, the U.S. would almost certainly still have a deficit with China because the U.S. has stopped making a lot of things while depending upon Chinese factories to make a lot of the goods that land on our shelves. And even if we weren't trading with China, if we weren't depending upon China to send us T-shirts and blue jeans and auto parts, it's not as if all that stuff would come back to the United States. We'd be buying it from someone else. We'd be buying it from India or Vietnam or Mexico.
So why do we have this narrative in our heads in the United States that there is a big, bad trade deficit with China?
It's good politics. It's a simplistic way to say that here's a handy way to keep score. You know, we think of a trade – I mean, what is a trade deficit? It means we are purchasing more stuff from a country than that country is purchasing from us. That sounds like, boy, we must be getting ripped off. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly the way that President Trump and Peter Navarro, who runs this National Trade Council he created and who's the author of a book called Death by China.
Pretty literal.
Yes. It's all about the China threat. I mean, this is a handy, though crude and extremely problematic, way to explain what has happened to large numbers of middle-class Americans who have lost a lot of economic security. And that part's real. But the idea that if we can just stop trade with China, that's going to be some sort of cure-all, that's an extremely flawed explanation. It makes for good politics. It's not good economics.
But the politics you're talking about, it's not just politics. It's something that people are voting for in the U.S. and in Europe. So doesn't that challenge this idea of globalization as an inevitable force?
It's not that we should buy into the other fantasy that mainstream economists and free traders in both major political parties have been selling us for many decades, which is that, you know, free trade is the answer to all of our problems. And if you have a problem with it, you're just a whiner or a loser. That's also a fantasy. I mean, what we've learned is that China, for instance, entering the World Trade Organization in 2001, had a much greater shock in large American communities.
And can you just quickly explain why that was such a significant moment?
Sure, because China is huge. And when China got into the WTO, it was ready. It was ready with entire regions that were concentrated on certain slices of industry, you know, whole towns that made plumbing supplies. I visited a town in Zhejiang province that suddenly was making 70% of the neckties on earth, you know, and that walloped parts of northern Italy that were dependent upon revenues from high quality neckties. I mean, there was an adjustment process that the world went through, and we didn't prepare for that. Our elite bought into this fantasy that, yeah, some jobs will be destroyed, but that will free up labor to go into new productive areas, and the creative powers that be will dream up new ideas. And maybe over time, that is in fact how our economy works. But, you know, as John Maynard Keynes famously said, in the long run, we're all dead. And the reality is that if an entire community in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Illinois suddenly experiences 50% unemployment, the impacts of that go far beyond what an economic model might have captured. I mean, suddenly, even if you are willing to do what the mainstream economists say that you should and, you know, accept you've lost your job and now you're going to move your family to Arizona where you can train to be a solar panel installer, well, 50% of your town is unemployed. Your house is not worth what it used to be. Maybe you can't sell it because you owe the bank more than your house is worth. Maybe the people in your community have now got depression and some of them are turning to drugs and there's crime and people don't want to buy your house and you've got problems that go far beyond your career. I mean, whole communities were leveled by this shock and we failed to address this. But the solution there is not to hurt economic growth and impede trade. The solution is to focus on preparing people for their next careers, to cushion the blow in terms of housing and education and healthcare. It's just very simplistic to say if we stop trading with China, somehow these problems will just vanish.
So with President Trump meeting with the president of China at Mar-a-Lago today, is all this talk of a dangerous trade deficit really just a message for disenfranchised voters in the United States? Or should we expect meaningful change between China and the United States now?
I'm going to weasel out of that question.
That's okay.
Noting that generally speaking, the U.S. and China are in a kind of codependent relationship. China depends upon access to the American market, which is the largest consumer market on earth, so that it can keep selling all of this stuff that it's making. And the U.S. is dependent upon China to continue to not only make our stuff, because so much of our own manufacturing and our own consumer economy is dependent upon this stream of goods coming in from China, but also that China then takes that money that it makes from this trade and buys our debt, which maintains borrowing costs at a low level in the United States. But President Trump has introduced an extremely volatile wild card to this equation. And China is having a very difficult time figuring out who they're dealing with, what he really wants. And again, he's taking trade advice from somebody who wrote a book called Death by China. So this is damn near the hardest time to predict in this relationship that any of us can recall.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today. President Trump says his outrage over the chemical weapons attack in Syria has made him reassess his views of the country's president, Bashar al-Assad.
It's very, very possible, and I will tell you, it's already happened, that my attitude toward Syria and Assad has changed very much.
In the past, Trump has said he views Assad as a potential ally in the war on terror. Trump's ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said that the U.S. is prepared to act on its own to hold the Syrian government accountable for its conduct.
When the United Nations consistently fails in its duty to act collectively, there are times in the life of states that we are compelled to take our own action.
And President Trump has removed his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, from the prestigious National Security Council, reversing an unusual appointment that immediately provoked a backlash. Bannon, a former right-wing media mogul, has no experience in national security, and critics said his presence on the council risked politicizing its work. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. Although I am coming down with a cold, I hope to see you tomorrow.